Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk, by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg, concludes our series on the lives of the Karmapas, focusing on His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa. Eric presents a brief sharing about the early life of His Holiness, about his education and his dramatic escape from Tibet at the turning of the new millennium in order to receive teachings from his masters and to serve the Dharma and Sangha, all of us. Some stories are shared, as well as personal thoughts on Karmapa's relationships to us and ours to him. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, how's everybody doing? Welcome to Sunday at Columbus KTC. We've been working our way through the biographies of all the Karmapas, using mostly this book as a reference, the history of the Karmapas, the Odyssey of the Tibetan Masters with the Black Crown. It's kind of, the story of Columbus KTC really is about living lineage, and one of the reasons that Kevin and I went and saw Stephen is because he's part of our living lineage here in Central Ohio. And when I first started coming, he appeared when Kempo Carther Rinpoche appeared, and I'll never forget Ed Powers nudging me, and he said, "Who's that guy? Do you know who that guy is?" "No," he said, "that's Stephen Hayes." I said, "Oh, who's Stephen Hayes?" He said, "They made a movie about him. He was the first bodyguard of His Holiness the Dalai Lama." I said, "Oh." And literally, I think I was, you were always sat about two-thirds of the way back on the right-hand side. I was suffering from various mental deficiencies, would try to sit close and pay attention. So I would sit up front, mostly on the left-hand side. And the first time I ever, Ed had nudged me, I was coming back, and it was weird. I was part of Columbus KTC, and you were from somewhere else. I didn't know you'd been coming since 82. I think this was like in the early 2000s. And it was like you welcomed me. It was beautiful. And that's when we met. And I felt a good connection ever since. One time as part of the prison project, I had one guy who wanted to learn Bushido. I don't know what Bushido is. I figured Stephen would know what Bushido was. So I wrote him to see if he would come and teach this guy. This is how dense I can be. You know, the state of Ohio Department of Corrections doesn't want the inmates to learn more martial arts than they already know, whatever that may be. So he kindly sent a book that he wrote something into this fella, and that was as good as we could do. And it wasn't one of those books that gave very explicit instructions about things. One of the more spiritual ones, that's the tie-in. So this is the last of the talks out of that book. It's about the 17th Karmapa, who I've had the good fortune to be with three times now. And there are a couple ways to do this kind of a talk in the time we have, since there's certainly easily more than an hour of material and personal stories. I can give you a little history, like the biographical stuff out of the book, and we'll do a little bit of that. And then there are a few stories. We'll do a little bit of that. But I want to leave, if I can, enough time for questions, because you may have questions about Karmapa, and I may know some answers. And if I don't, other people here might. In my mind, since he's the head of our lineage and truly one of the extraordinary beings in this world at this time, it's really important that you realize that you already have a very intimate connection to him, whether you know it or not. And everything that we've done up until now, from talking about Tolopa and Naropa and Marpa and Milarepa and Gampopa and the first Karmapa and all of them till this one, is all about letting you know that not just that the conceptual truths of Buddhism, that you have Buddha nature and you are connected to each other and to everything through interdependence, but that you have a very intimate family connection to the Karmapas. And that's my hope, is to convey some of that and inspire you to actually look online a little bit and read some biographical material, but especially, there are a lot of his teachings online. They've done a really good job recording and transcribing all his teachings at the Munlams and all of that. And get to know him, because he's an unfailing support for all of us, and regards all of us as his support and his family, which is no small thing, because he's got a really hard job. If you haven't noticed, samsara is a little bumpy. It's just not a smooth ride. And it's especially so, oddly enough, for Karmapas and Dalai Lamas and His Holiness the Sakya Trizin. And I'm not sure who is the new leader of the Nyingma now, but all of them, along with enlightenment and along with having all the spiritual goodies that we're kind of graspy about, it's not like they don't have the experience of the bumpiness of samsara's ride. And while we depend on them, certainly they depend on us too. So this was what I was going to end the talk with, but I think I'm obviously starting the talk with this. So, you know, the famous mantra that was bestowed on us by previous Karmapas, Karmapa Cheno, Karmapa Nomi, which is a really powerful thing when you're in the midst of your own bumpy ride. Remember always to include with that, you know, a dedication and prayers that their activity can be unfettered and without hindrance or obstacles, and whatever obstacles there are, that they can be removed. Because indeed we are truly connected. When I first saw Karmapa, I think it was 2008 when he first came to the United States, and I went up to KTD and we were all just in awe, because frankly, what Stephen said, just talking about people from Columbus, but I think it's true all over the United States and the rest of the world too. It's not easy to create community in any sense, ever, anywhere, under any guise. And it's especially not easy to create a Buddhist community that's trying to follow the teachings of the Buddha and make that the core of what we do. And he looked at us with the kindest eyes I think I've ever seen. And he said, I know what all of you are doing. And honestly, there were like 350 people or so under this tent, because that's really pretty much all you can get up at KTD. That's kind of maximum number of people the fire department will allow up there. And I can honestly tell you, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was like, we were saying Karmapa Cheno, and he was saying, Eric, I know you. You know, I was saying, I know you, you should know me, and he was saying, I know you. And I came to believe very deeply that that's true. He made the promise that goes all the way back, I think, to the second Karmapa, that if in the evening after the sun sets, we look at the moon and we think of him, he'll be connected. And I totally believed it. It was like one of those things somebody says to you that's kind of fantastical and magical, and you say, yeah, sure. But there was no yeah, sure in me. It was like, and you know, I'm a little skeptical. It was like, yeah, this is true. So that's really what I want to start with. It's not just that this is a great guy with, you know, kind of a rock star lama attracting tens of thousands of people wherever he goes. It's not just that. Just being here and being connected to this place, even in this transitional time that we're in, connects you to this being who is doing revolutionary things in Buddhism. He kind of single-handedly among the Tibetan hierarchy found a way to fully ordain women. He cares about women. He's kind of transforming the way people see interdependence through all his work in the environment and his care for the health of the physical planet, the four elements, as it were. And he's also caring deeply about the education of tulkus. He's really said some radical stuff about that, in that, yeah, these people in previous lifetimes have achieved a high degree of realization and have chosen to come back to benefit beings. But guess what? We're not doing a good enough job educating them. And he's looking at the education in terms of helping them understand not just the Buddhist tradition and the Buddhist teachings, but also science and math and computers. And by doing that, making them even more effective, you know, really giving them tools to help us. These are resources that they need. And so you've got a guy who's encountered a lot of resistance, even from within his own camp, in a way. I'm not supposed to say that out loud, probably, but it's true. I've got it on good authority. There's certain people of the old guard that aren't comfortable with all of this. I only say that in the sense that be connected to him and absolutely dedicate the merit of your practice to his activity, without a doubt. It'll connect you more powerfully and in important ways. It'll also connect us to each other in important ways and in healthy ways. I'm fairly certain Kempo Kartha Rinpoche wouldn't mind me saying that. So I like to be able to say it. At the end of one of his teachings, I had an interview with him, and I said, after a two-hour teaching, I said, so what you were really saying is that we should love each other and we should be in harmony with each other. He said, that's it. And he had a little tear in his eye, and it's like, of course, he gave an exposition the way only he can do it of some stuff that was just mind-blowing on another level, but it boils down to that. So that's really what this series of talks about, the living lineage that we hold, is all about. Typically, we actually start these Dharma talks with chanting the refuge prayer together, and I still want to do that. So we chant this three times, and the reason it's three times is that first we're resonating with the three jewels that we think of as outside of ourselves. The second time is to connect to the connections that we have with the three jewels. as those connections are also living. And the third time is to resonate, to connect with the three jewels within us. Sanje Chudong Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin Sok Jipe Sunam Ki Rola Penchir Sanje Drupasho Sanje Chudong Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin Sogi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Rupasho Sanje Chudam Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin So Yi Pe So Nam Ki Rola Pin Shir Sanje Rupa Sho. Thank you. So the 17th Karmapa. You know, the 16th Karmapa passed away in America. And outside of Chicago, in a medical center, he had cancer, and doctors brought him here for treatment. And it was a long time before the 17th Karmapa was identified, which, given the diaspora, it caused a lot of problems. You can read about those online too. That's not for this morning. But in 1985, a child was born to a nomadic family in Tibet in a little town. It was a summer dwelling place that they had called Bakor. And it's a long story, but they already had some other kids. There was an eldest son and some daughters, and they wanted another son. So they went to the local lama, who was a Drukpa Khaju, and there was a monastery near there, and they asked him to do prayers and stuff. And he said, okay, fine, I'll do prayers, but when he gets old enough, you have to give him to me for training. Literally, that's the way they used to roll over there. And within a relatively short period of time, his mom was pregnant, and she had all kinds of like interesting dreams during the pregnancy and all that kind of thing. And in 1982, or 85, excuse me, this child was born. Weird stuff happened that were seen by a lot of people, a lot of historians in the area, you know, the rainbows in the sky thing and all that. And the cuckoo is a rare bird in Tibet, but occasionally they show up and they sing pretty songs. And the day of the birth, a cuckoo landed on their place and started singing a song. The child was born. And there were all kinds of atmospheric events, let's put them that way. Rainbows and specular highlights of the sun, which made it look like there were three of them and things like that. They figured that the kid was special. The lama from the monastery confirmed, yeah, this is the one I want to train. And his older sister, Pelzor, named him Apogaga, which means happy brother. He just seemed to be happy. And he had this penchant, even from a young age, of being able to do things that were needed for the community. I heard him talk about this. He was just a kid. He didn't know what he was doing. But you know how kids like to play church and stuff like that when they're young? He liked that. He actually liked building little monasteries out of rocks and things like that. It's like crazy. I mean, this is not necessarily the biographical information you were looking for, but you know. And he, from an early age, learned the seven-line supplication to Guru Rinpoche. That was he said this up at KTD. That was his favorite thing. He loved chanting the seven-line prayer. And he said if he could chant that three times, he could somehow, he doesn't know how. He said his mind always seemed ordinary to him. But he would know how to find lost animals, which was a big deal because they were a shepherding nomadic culture, and know how to find water when they were wandering around and needing to find water, and so on and so forth. And so even when he was like a three-year-old or so, he knew that he had some connection to Guru Rinpoche. He hadn't been identified yet, but he did go, and the Kempo at this monastery did give him the training that was traditionally given a tulku, or reincarnate lama, from a young age, you know, starting when he was, I don't know, 4 or 5, and lasting for a while. And then, and he would be there when they were there, and then when they were wandering around herding the yaks and the goats and the sheep, he wasn't there, and he was with his family. So that was how life was. It was very, very beautiful and natural and connected to the earth. And when he talks about it, you can tell he loves it and misses it a lot, even though now he's got a life full of skyscrapers and jet planes and all that. His heart's really in the hills, you know. The hills are alive with the sound of music. He actually hears it. So in 1992, they had this rhythm. In 1992, he was 7 years old. He implored his parents to return to their summer home in Bagor, where he was born, a month early. At the same time, this is weird, Thay Sithu, who had found finally the prediction letter sewn into an amulet. I don't know if you've seen these, but they're these, like, lamas sometimes will give you protection amulets, and they look like they're just a brocade pouch. And inside there's like usually a mandala or a blessing or something, and they wrap them with thread in a certain kind of way. They're really kind of beautiful. A little like dream catchers in the Native American tradition, except small, wrapping around these mandalas. Then they put them in a brocade pouch. You wear it around your neck as a protection or a connection to your lama. So the 16th Karmapa had given one of these to Thay Sithu that he wore around his neck, and he had this kind of, he was on retreat, and he had this kind of insight. I should open this up and see what's in there, which is very unusual. You're not supposed to do it. But if you're a Thay Sithu, you can really pretty much do whatever you want. So, I mean, it's true. So he opened it up and he looked, and within it was a little gold envelope with the 16th Karmapa's handwriting on it that said, to be opened in the year, I think it was the Iron Horse, or I can't remember, I have it down, but whichever year, and it was that year. Crazy, right? So he opened it up, and there was the prediction letter saying where to find his rebirth. And they tried to figure it out from the description, and they figured out it was Bagor. And he sent word to Serpu in Tibet, because by that time Thay Sithu was in India, and they mounted a search party and went out to find this child. There's a lot just to that story. It's pretty amazing. Long story short, though, they did. They found him, and they wouldn't have had he not had the kid Apo Gaga not said, hey, let's get there a month early this year. That's really something. So they showed up and they found him and did the usual, you know, testing. They test these children to see if they're authentic by having them identify stuff from their previous birth. If, you know, if they can identify them, then they go on to do some further things. And all that happened. And they took this seven-year-old with them back to Serpu. He had already packed a little knapsack. This is weird. This is a story his mother... And she said, this was 2 days before, she said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm going to find my monastery in a couple days. Crazy. So as he made his way from Bagor down to Serpu, which is a, you know, it's over the mountains and through the woods and in the Tibetan Himalayas, just crowds just appeared kind of out of nowhere. And he had... They obviously had a magnetic guy, and when he got to Serpu, over time, they did enthrone him there and gave him the name Origen Trinley Dorje. Origen is, of course, the name of Guru Rinpoche. So that all, I just found that all pretty interesting. His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, at that same time, had a dream that they would find this child in Bagor. He described the landscape and the exact way that the houses were laid out and where the river was and stuff like that, and they figured out that was that. He got his instruction in Serpu. You know, there's a lot to learn when you're a Karmapa. It's not like they're born remembering everything. In fact, they're born like any other baby is born. I hear stories, though, that they learn faster. Lama Zopa, who is now the administrator of KTD, was in his second three-year retreat at the same time that Karmapa was still doing some learning. He had already made it to India, and he said, I was studying the same book he was. There's this book called The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech. It's like this thick, and it's this incredible discourse on Shantideva. And he said, it took me all 3 years just to get through it and understand it. He said, Karmapa was studying it. He started at the same time. He was done in 2 months. He might have read it before, maybe in a couple lifetimes before. That's the point. But he still had to have the conditions necessary to learn it. In his earlier life, though, he was learning in Serpu with some high lamas that were still there that didn't make it to India. And he stayed there and he was doing fine until they were older and they passed away. His education was taken over by the Kempo and by a Lama Nima, who was a very great scholar. But he kind of, after 2 years, got to the point where he needed the lineage transmissions, he needed the empowerments, he needed the stuff his teachers could give him that were in India. And because of the problems between China and India and between Tibet and India, these guys like Thai Sithu and all that, they weren't being allowed to come in to Tibet. So he decided at 14 years old, he needed to escape. And that was the stuff of legend. It happened in late December of 1999, and the escape took through the first days of 2000. So while we were all worried about Y2K, here's what he did. This is kind of cool. Took a while, they planned. One of the lamas that was teaching him had friends out in the community, and they got spies to observe when the Chinese were doing what. And they figured out when they were asleep or watching TV at night, and they decided, okay, that's when we're going to do this. And at that time, they decided Lama Nima would stay in Karmapa's room, and the cook had to know because he had to not be surprised that Karmapa wasn't there for the food and all that kind of stuff. And Karmapa told the Chinese, I have to go into retreat. Retreat meaning he wasn't allowed to go to a cave in the mountain. He had to stay in his room and do a retreat. So Lama Nima stayed in the room and he was playing the ritual horns and banging the drums and, you know, bells and smells. Tibetan Buddhism just great for that. And making all kinds of racket, and they thought it was Karmapa doing his practice. And the cook was bringing the food as if he was in there. And meanwhile, with two other guys and a guy in the town, he had made his way to a chapel, and he jumped out the window onto a flat roof and then jumped from the roof down into the snow below. And they went on foot to find this jeep that was waiting for him full of jerry cans and food and all that. And they beat it towards the border with Nepal. At the border, they sent the two monks that were with him in the jeep to try to make it through the border. And Karmapa and two other guys, there were five of them, decided to go on foot. And it was, you know, at least 10,000, 15,000 feet up in the Himalayas at the border in the middle of winter. It's cold. And it's difficult, but they did it. And they made it through and reconnected with the jeep, which after that broke down. And then they had to walk into a village nearby and pass themselves off as pilgrims. Karmapa played the role of the attendant of his attendant, because he was so young. And it was, they said, you know, we have to go on our pilgrimage, but we'll come back for the jeep later, because they just didn't want to stir anything up. And they asked the quickest way to Mustang, which where they had to go. It was very high in the Himalayas. And they said it was through this pass. So they went on foot, and it was difficult. It took days. They were frozen. They didn't have rest. They didn't have food and so on. And once they were in Mustang, they did get a minute with the king of Mustang, whoever that was, and the king, like, was trustworthy. So they told him, and he said, look, if you can make it down to this place where Westerners go, you know, climbers in the Himalayas, Westerners go to pick up a helicopter, you know, to Everest or to Kathmandu, I can get you on that helicopter and we can get you to Kathmandu. And so they did that. They walked in, got the helicopter. This is crazy, right? And they flew to outside Kathmandu, picked up some taxis, got them to the border, and they got through the border into India. Then picked up a train to get to Lucknow, where they were met by His Eminence Thai Sithu's attendant, Lama Tenom. Lama Tenom. And that was the story of the escape. And we all, I think Jelaine was there, we all found out a little later what had happened. And it was pretty, pretty exciting. After that, the Indian government, of course, imprisoned him and basically in Bodh Gaya under the protection of the Dalai Lama at Gyuto Monastery. And he wasn't allowed to travel until 2008. He literally was kind of in prison. And that's some of that political stuff that we don't need to get into. And in 2008, he made that first trip that I told you about to America. Came back in 2011, and then came back again, I think it was 2015. At that point, the Indian government wouldn't allow him to come back into India. How about that? So he's kind of been stateless for a while. I'm not sure where he is right now. He was hanging out at the KTC in New Jersey for a long time because his old attendant that helped him escape is the Lama at the KTC in New Jersey. How about that? If you ever go there, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. I wanted to give you... We'll run out of time, so what I would like to do is read you one story I just came across about learning. And the Karmapa is this very unassuming person. He is not interested in being flashy in any way. He's not interested in doing something woo-woo for you to believe in him or something. So I came across this story that Mingyur Rinpoche tells. Do y'all know Mingyur Rinpoche? Great meditation teacher that... Yeah, his new book is called In Love with the World. He just completed a 4-year wandering retreat that was just incredible. So Karmapa says, people think I'm intelligent, but I'm not so sure. He said, intelligent people have a danger. It's easy for them to be boring. So Mingyur Rinpoche says, part one, one of the deep impressions that I had about the Karmapa was during the first few months after he came to India. At that time, Trungpa Rinpoche was selected to teach the Karmapa, and I was selected to accompany the Karmapa to study, as I had already studied for 7 years. I felt that I was very experienced, and I was a bit arrogant. Since the Karmapa was very young and had just started to learn the teachings, I thought, oh, I had more experience while he's just a newbie. That's part one. Part two. After that, I got to know the Karmapa better, and I realized he had such a great wisdom, and he didn't look like a normal human. The more I looked at him, the more I found him not a human. Everybody laughed when they heard it, but I guess it's funnier when he tells it. The thought that he is a human diminished gradually. And at that time, Karmapa was only very young. Part three. Here I would like to share a story with you. One day, Karmapa summoned me and said, let's have a competition and see who can memorize the scripture faster. Because that's what they do in tulku training. They memorize whole books, like lots of them. It's crazy and amazing. So they're doing that, and he said, hence we were required to find a scripture that neither of us had read before, and we managed to find one. It was a 1.5-page Tibetan scripture, and I promptly agreed to take the challenge. There were 2 copies of the scripture, and each of us took 1 copy. I sat facing him and began to memorize the scripture painstakingly by reading it aloud. On the contrary, the Karmapa did not make any noise while he was memorizing the scripture. He read the scripture slowly. And Rinpoche demonstrates how Karmapa read the scripture, and the audience laughed. Well, I was trying hard to read the scripture. Usually, I will be able to memorize it after reading it about 100 times. Hence, I kept reading and reading. Part 5. When I was on my 10th time of reading, the Karmapa said, I've finished. At that moment, I was totally stunned. But I didn't believe him and exclaimed, impossible. Let's see you recite it. Next, I took his copy and he began to recite the scripture. He recited it very smoothly from the beginning till the end. While I couldn't even memorize the first sentence of the scripture at that point, my arrogance was being half subdued. On another day, we had a debate on the Pramana Vartika, which is a commentary on valid cognition. It's like the magnum opus of Dharmakirti. This is like really thick philosophical stuff. Dharmakirti was one of the main teachers in the 7th century northern India Buddhism. And valid cognition is like, it's about, okay, if emptiness is our reality, how does anything appear? And how do we know what appears to us is valid? It's like It's really thick. So they're having a debate on that, and he said, I was the one sitting down to answer while Karmapa stood to ask questions. That's the way Tibetan debate goes. The debate went on, and suddenly I was totally speechless and couldn't respond. There are usually four ways to answer, but I couldn't even think of one. Part 7, hence, I thought, can I find the answers in the scriptures? And the Karmapa used logic, thinking that couldn't be found in the scriptures. Hence, I couldn't utter a word except grinning sheepishly. He said, henceforth, my arrogance had been completely subdued. Here's what Karmapa says about himself. Generally, people say that I am Karmapa, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva. They say what they say, but when I look at myself, all I see is an ordinary being with afflictions and faults, not someone who is free of faults and endowed with all the qualities as others think. And I can honestly tell you he's like that. He longs for renunciation just like we all do, actually. He longs to see through samsara just like we all do. He longs to be able to let go just like we all do. And yeah, he's kind of like our older brother, further ahead on the path, but he's totally in it with us. So that's what I wanted to share with him about you. Obviously, there's a lot more, and I had to make it short, but I also want to leave a few minutes for questions. So the question mic is open. Please use it.
I was lucky enough to see Mingyur Rinpoche's book, and he has a chapter in it called Memento Mori.
Hmm.
And that really piqued my interest because it's like a Catholic mantra.
Hmm. Can you say more about that?
Yes. Well, he's writing about impermanence, and then he said he remembered a story that he heard about a skier in like the Swiss Alps near France, who got lost from his party, and he was then it was snowing and didn't know where he was. He kept walking and he thought he saw a light somewhere, and it was like a French Catholic monastery, and it didn't look like anybody was there. But he knocked on the door. The monks were home, and he asked if he could just have shelter. So they said, sure. And he said he had this, they gave him a nice little room with a bed, and he went to sleep. And then at midnight, a monk knocked on the door, opened the door, and said, Memento Mori. And of course, he knew that was like, remember death.
Mm.
And he said, well, you know, these monks like to live in reality. And then at 1 a.m., the monk knocked on the door and said, Memento Mori. I guess that's how they do it. I didn't know that they did it in some monasteries like that. But.
That's cool.
Yeah, Eric, I'm curious. I've read different stories about Karmapa, and you mentioned you don't know where he is right now. Is there anybody, I mean, like, the real story, where is he? Could any of us go and meet him if he's hanging out at the New Jersey?
Yeah, I think it'd be good if you called ahead. yeah, sure. I think so. What happened was he decided to turn in his Indian passport and get another passport, I think from Dominica.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a more widely accepted passport all over the world. That pissed the Indian government off, and they've been difficult pretty much nonstop and wouldn't allow him to have a visa to come back for the Munlam. He had some medical issues.
Do you know what those are?
I think he was basically run down, to tell you the truth. Wow. It was generally just cooked to the... he was getting crispy around the edges, you know, just with all the demands on him. And I think he had an overall... He says in his address to the last Munlam that he had an overall feeling of not feeling well, and that brought on a sense of depression. He was like... awesome in that, because he wasn't trying to put on a show. He was saying, yeah, you think I'm Karmapa. I'm telling you that, you know, I'm a human being. And so a lot of people were unhappy that he doesn't have a perfect life. I was overjoyed in his honesty, to tell you the truth. Yeah. And so I know he was resting in New Jersey mostly, but he could be traveling around. He's doing a lot with education. He's doing a lot with the environment, but it's not a big public show. So I'm not sure where he is. I'm guessing that he's somewhere in the United States, but I'm not sure.
Wow. I mean, is this like a secret, or just you happen to not know?
I happen to not know. Yeah. Oh, people know. I'm sure Kempo Cartha Rinpoche knows exactly where he is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. No, he's not hiding out or anything. It's just, you know, when he goes and does something, it becomes a handbill and a poster and an advertisement, and 10,000, 20,000 people show up. Yeah. They're not doing that.
You know, I saw on a TV show with Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
You know, they had the Karmapa. So apparently he was still in India when this show was filmed. Did you? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, all these people who don't know the Karmapa, you know, but you see him there, and, you know, Morgan Freeman is asking him basic questions, and but he seemed to be in India at the
time. That was made probably 3-4 years ago, though.
Ah, okay, yeah. You know, it just seems remarkable to me that... these things are taking place. Number one, India won't let him back in.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to stay in the West.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I were a Karma Kagyu dedicated practitioner, you know, I'd be kind of interested. Well, wait a minute. I mean, this guy's on the loose here in the West. And what does that say about, like, the, you know, lineage, as you were talking about, lineage.
Mm-hmm.
West is kind of like Dharma wilderness, you know. Mm-hmm. We're out here trying our best to figure this stuff out. India, Nepal, Tibet, that's where it all is. And now, no. He's in the West.
Yeah.
Can't get back. Certainly can't get back to Tibet.
Right.
Nepal.
Oh, really can't,
Man, Nepal, I was over there in January and February of this year, and it's creepy what the Chinese are doing. They're building an international airport in Pokhara. So we'll do it. We'll build that for you. You know, they're building a road up to Mustang.
I heard about that.
I mean, like a major highway, like I-71 up to Mustang. Oh, we'll handle that. We'll handle that. And now the Nepal government cracks down on all the Tibetans.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese don't have to do that at all. The Nepal government will run in and do that. And so he's pretty much in the West. Be really interesting, you know.
Right.
If he gets his health back, figures out what's going on, he may be the first major, you know, Tibetan reincarnated Lama, you know, the Karmapa, to actually say, no, I'm going to settle down in the West. This is where I will be.
Yeah.
Move to the Rockies or the Appalachians or something so it can be in the mountains. But I find it really interesting that people don't know where he is, and there doesn't seem to be a a big interest in where he is.
Well, I think there are people who know where he is. And, you know, the word I've gotten, you know, I know some people who know where he is. But they've asked me, they just said, no, but, you know, I'm the kind of person that when they're ready to say something, they will. They'll ask. And when I ask, and, you know, it's like Lama Yeshe Jamso is a good friend. He translates for him. He clearly is in touch. Karmapa calls him up, says, come translate for me, you know, and he appears. What's that? Yeah, Kenpo Tankyong was his attendant. He used to be the president of KTD. He'll know. So it's people know, but for whatever his activity right now is, it needs to not be a public activity, and I respect that. That's sort of where I'm at. I saw him, I think 2015 was last time he was doing a lot of public stuff, and then it was after that that he took literally a couple years to rest, to practice, to get his health back. And now I know he's doing stuff. I just don't know what he's doing. I think a lot has to do with the education of tulkus, because he realizes that the tulku system is absolutely necessary. He's written a little about this, to keep the lineage healthy generation after generation. It was a brilliant thing that was instituted by the first Karmapa. It wasn't just that it's a mystical, spiritual woo-woo. It was brilliant in terms of how to keep this set of teachings alive and well through hundreds of years. He sees it that way. And he also sees that the world has changed dramatically in the last 50 years, and that tulkus need to know science and need to know math, need to know computers. That's not in the tulku curriculum. When you're memorizing whatever the name of that book I couldn't pronounce was, you know, it's like you don't have time necessarily to also learn math and science. So I believe he's working on that. He did accomplish with the Dalai Lama this complete retooling of the education for nuns. And I think 2018 or early 2019 was the first class of full ordination for nuns in the Tibetan traditions. He did that, you know, but that's not the kind of thing that you're out running around doing public teachings and empowerments with. He's working with heads of lineages and the background stuff in order to make this thing very healthy. That's the way I see it. I think he's gotten healthy. I think now he wants Buddhism to be healthy. And certainly the environmental thing never goes away. He's just constantly working with that. I hope that's a good enough answer. So I don't know, but I think I could know if I really wanted to be manipulative and put the arm on somebody.
Last September, I was up at KTD for the first few days of the 10-day teaching.
Yeah.
And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche begged off on the first teaching session because he said that the Karmapa had been there that evening and they had stayed up very late partying together.
I love that. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that today is the third Sunday Sangha lunch at Northeast Chinese. So anybody who would like to join us,
cool,
please come. Thanks.
So, as usual, I've run overtime. Something that Karmapa has been teaching about that seems to get missed in the, generally what I read, is he talks about taking Buddhism seriously and particularly taking the vows seriously. And he said, in order to receive the vows in a pure way, what that means is that you really have to accomplish renunciation. So what does that mean? It really means letting go of the whole idea that samsara is ever going to give you what you want or what you need in order to be free. more importantly, not about what you want, what you need to be free. Most of us, most of the time, figure if we massage it all just right and we avoid what we don't want, somehow it'll take the bumps out of our road. And the truth is, no matter how perfectly we massage it or how perfectly we avoid things we want to avoid, we still get bumps in the road. And when we get to the realization of, yeah, this just, no matter what I do, this doesn't work, I need some realization of a different approach to this precious life. This is something he's been teaching. That's where the vows of individual liberation actually come in, where you really commit yourself to saying, yeah, life has its ups and downs, but I'm going to commit myself to learning kindness and compassion today, or this minute, or the next, even when the chips are really down, because that's what he seems to want to convey right now, is that we need to do that on every level, interpersonally and with the environment especially, and with all religious traditions, which is something I think he got from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who is big on the way we're connected rather than the way we're divided. So, in that spirit, let's dedicate the merit of having gathered here together on this wonderful Sunday, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. That's why I wore a flowered shirt today. Instead of using the traditional dedication, let's just feel the goodness of taking a breath, being alive. Feel the goodness of the Dharma and the encouragement to be kind and compassionate. And dedicate the merit to our own awakening and the awakening of all beings to this very goodness. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.